somebody's going to limit my travel, it should be a communist, not my own government.
Hi, I'm Tim Cavanaugh for Reason TV. We're here with Congressman Jeff Flake, Republican from Arizona, and one of the great voices for limited government in Washington. Congressman, great to have you with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You're the former head of the Goldwater Institute, right. And as an Arizonan, can we talk a little bit about the legacy of Barry and to what degree is current Arizona politics and current Republican politics nationwide infused with a Goldwater spirit?
Well, certainly Arizona is. I grew up in northern Arizona, rural Arizona, in the town of Snowflake, five generations back. And so, similar story to the Goldwater family. And there is a kind of a libertarian, certainly limited government, independent streak that runs through Arizona, certainly through rural Arizona and old Arizona. And I think Arizona politics is still, to some extent, defined by that.
Late in Goldwater's career, when he sort of went liberal on some issues, equal treatment of gays and lesbians and so forth, that was viewed as a shift in his thinking. And I mean, did that really reveal a shift in his thinking, or was it really a shift that had occurred in the Republican Party?
I think there was some of both, to be frank. I think some of his positions you could ascribe to simply this is traditional conservatism, more classical liberalism, but there were a few nuances that were differences in, I mean, a direct difference from an opinion or a position that he had held previously. But by and large, I mean, he was still defined as a man that believes in limited government, economic freedom, and individual liberty.
How much of this is Arizona itself? I mean, the climate, the type of people who settle there, and so forth.
I think that there is some of that, and certainly we like to think of ourselves that way. So, I think that's a good description.
Where do you put the current Congress and the current actually administration too on the idea of limited government? How much of it is for real? How much of it is party politics?
Well, if you look at both parties, we've both behaved rather horribly over the past few decades. If you just take Republicans, between the years 2000 and 2006, when we controlled both chambers and the White House, we behaved very badly. And I like to say, we were headed toward this fiscal cliff that we're headed toward long before Barack Obama took the wheel. He simply stepped on the accelerator quite a bit, and we're going to get there a lot faster. But make no mistake, we were headed there. And so we didn't do, Republicans have deviated quite a bit from our limited government roots. And if you look at those years when we controlled most of the federal government, that's a pretty good indication of where we had gone to. We had pretty much kind of run out of ideas, if you will, at that point. We'd passed in the 90s the Freedom to Farm Act, for example, getting farmers on a glide path away from subsidies. In 2002, we passed the Farm Security Act, which basically brought a lot of those subsidies back and really did what, the old rhetoric that Ronald Reagan used to use, freedom for security. We not only did that in practice, but we even gave away the rhetoric, replacing the Freedom to Farm Act with the Farm Security Act. Yeah. And that was just one example. You had the prescription drug benefit, you had bloated, transportation bills, earmarking gone awry, and it just wasn't a good 6 years for us. But we've kind of hit the road to Damascus, I think, after 2006, and elected a lot of new freshmen in the Republican Party who have turned things around a bit, but we'll see whether we're serious or how serious we are in the coming weeks, coming months.
How much of this is changing conversation? Like, it's still, even now, really hard to get the idea out there that all this spending is not actually causing an economic recovery, and the argument that we, of whether we need to spur the economic recovery first or pay off the deficit first is a non-argument. How much does even the media coverage play into that?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, we say that in our rhetoric as Republicans, we'll talk about the failed stimulus and whatnot, but then when we put an appropriation bill that basically takes us just back to 2008, or at best, maybe 2006, before the stimulus, before a lot of ramp up in spending. Then we have a lot of Republicans pulling back and saying, we can't do that because the economy needs this kind of spending. And so I'm not sure if we believe our own rhetoric sometimes. And we'll see in the coming weeks, we'll really know when we have to raise the debt ceiling. We'll see how serious we are about putting in place some things that will benefit us in the long term.
You mentioned earmark-contained pork, and for a while there you were the hog butcher to the world, or the great face of anti-earmark momentum in the House. What's come of that, and where do we stand with that now?
Well, that's one great success, I think, that we've had over the past few years. Earmarks represent only a small part of the budget, but they affect the larger budget in ways that people simply don't see. When you have an earmark in a bill, then you tend to support that bill no matter how bloated it becomes. And the horse trading, log rolling that goes on with earmarks tends to bloat the entire government. And just the kind of the pernicious nature of basically conceding that this pot of federal money is needed for my district or for this company or for this nonprofit organization, that any right-minded conservative would realize, that's really not good for the federal government to be spending in that way. But you get caught up in it, as we did as Republicans, and it's tough to get away from. But we have. And one of the first effects you saw earlier this year when we passed the H.R. 1, the big continuing resolution, there were no earmarks in that bill, none. And because there were none, people actually went to the House floor and won votes on spending cuts. Like 49 amendments were passed that actually cut spending. And that would have been unheard of just a few years ago. And it only happened because there was no log rolling. There was no appropriator looking at you saying, you take this one down, your earmark will be taken out in in conference.
Is there other stuff like that, Robert's Rules of Orders type things that you can do to kind of, cut back some of the abuses?
Yeah, and we're trying a lot of them, some of us. I'm now on the Appropriations Committee, surprise, surprise, and it's a bit of a lonely experience there. But we do what we can in ways that will raise some of these issues publicly. For example, within the Farm Bill, we've passed massive subsidies for cotton. We subsidize cotton to the extent that we run afoul of our own international trade agreements. Brazil sued in the WTO and won. And so instead of cutting down our own subsidies to our own cotton farmers, we've told Brazil, we'll pay you to subsidize your own cotton if you don't pursue the case. And so for the past couple of years and for the next few, we'll be paying about $150 million a year to Brazil to subsidize their cotton so we can subsidize our own.
Yeah.
And myself and a few other members decided to remove that subsidy in committee, and we were able to do that because it's difficult to defend that publicly.
The subsidy to Brazil.
Yes,
right.
To Brazil.
But still subsidizing our own cotton.
Right, but when we removed it in committee, then when it got to the floor, they used the same kind of rules that you can get out of Robert's Rules of Order or whatever, and removed my amendment that removed the subsidy. And so we had to do it again on the floor, but we were able to. We'll see how far that goes, because obviously this is just the House version. You've got to have the Senate agree. But for every person that uses the rules to cut spending, you'll have individuals use those same rules to put that spending back. So it's a bit of a shell game.
Yeah. You're speaking about trade, and you've been a big proponent of free trade with Cuba as an anti-regime.
Right.
Not specify, but right. Not as something that's, Castro is a great guy,
no.
So we should trade with him. Where do we stand with that? And has the Obama administration taken us a little bit forward on Cuba policy?
They have. I was able to pass legislation early in my career in Washington, 2002, I think 2003, to prohibit funding for enforcing the travel ban. And that's what I've been mostly concerned about, is a travel ban, just the law that prohibits Americans from being able to travel to Cuba. I've always thought that just as silly. the whole trade embargo was silly, frankly, but travel ban chief among it. I could never get President Bush to sign that kind of legislation, so twice it was removed before he would sign it. But President Obama has liberalized the travel requirements, and so Cuban Americans, for example, can travel at will as much as they want, and so you have some 300,000 to 400,000 visits to Cuba just in the past year, mostly Cuban Americans. That's a good thing. That's a great thing. To the extent that it's possible in a communist system, more Cubans now are living kind of outside of the state, if you will, and being more economically independent than they were before, and that's a good thing. But we still don't have the ability of the average American to just pick up and say, I want to travel to Cuba. You have to go in and get a license, and either a religious license, a humanitarian license, some educational license, and just doesn't make any sense at all.
That's from the U.S., for the U.S. state.
That's right. These prohibitions, these sanctions are not on Cuba. They're on Americans, and that's what makes it so strange. And we have all this talk today about Americans, if the Republican Party is becoming more isolationist because a lot of Republicans don't want to intervene in Libya. And I always say, hey, who's isolationist here? Who wants to prohibit Americans from traveling to Cuba, for crying out loud? But, you know, if we lifted our travel restrictions on Americans traveling to Cuba, the next day, I'm quite confident that the Castro regime would impose some of their own restrictions, because they want the revenue. They don't want the influence that comes with travel. But if somebody's going to limit my travel, it should be a communist, not my own government. And that's how I feel.
Okay. Other stuff that happened during the long period of Republican ascendancy was the Patriot Act.
Right.
Where we have, you know, we've gone through many different sunset revisions over and over, and everything seems to keep coming back. Do we have any hope of whittling back USA Patriot in a serious way?
Well, we have in some way. So when the initial proposal came from the Bush administration, myself, Ron Paul, Bobby Scott, Bob Barr, a lot of us sat down and said, you know, what do we really need and what can we take away? And of some 50-some proposals, we whittled it down to less than 20. And so we made some headway from the beginning. And then the provisions that were troublesome, we sunsetted. And so we've revisited them a few times since. I still have misgivings about some of the things related to the Patriot Act, the national security letters, for example, that just allow government to get information from businesses without required warrants. I had trouble with the library provision, for example, and access to public records that individuals get. And so I inserted language or added amendments during the last sunset that moved that up the chain, that would require the director of the FBI to sign off personally on these things. And so we've been able to attach some amendments and some protections as we've gone along. And we've been able to sunset these provisions, and we revisit them. It's kind of it's an uneasy balance as you go along. And when you meet with the intelligence community, they'll certainly tell you that these provisions, some of these have been very useful and have maybe kept us safe in certain situations. And it's difficult to talk about some of those publicly. But it will always be a balancing act as we go along, balancing civil liberties with the necessary tools that they need. But I've been convinced over the years that the administration, whether it's Republican or Democrat, will always seek the maximum number of tools, and it's up to Congress to go in and ensure that civil liberties are protected. And we've tried, and perhaps we can do a little better job.
I got to pry a little bit. When you're meeting with security types and they're, you know, making the case for how such and such, you know, unraveled, whatever, how much of that is backed up by evidence, and how much is take our word for it?
You have some of both, but some of it can be backed up. Some of it, for example, you know, on these library provisions and other things, you can actually ask them, how many times was this power, or this authority that you have invoked? And they have to tell you. And I mean, there's always a possibility that they don't tell you everything that they're required to, but I guess you just have to assume that they will. But on some things, you don't know if simply the deterrent value of the ability to track all mobile devices or to have roving wiretaps or other things keeps people who would do us harm from doing so. And that's difficult to quantify.
Right.
But you have a lot of members of Congress who take this very seriously and are pushing. I've been in those meetings. I've heard the questions that are asked. Some have been uncomfortable for those in the intelligence community. But like I say, we try to strike a balance, and we try to, because technology in particular progresses so much, you have to sunset some of these provisions and revisit them every few years to see what you're doing.
You mentioned isolationism. How much of the issue here is that there's a new administration and there's some sort of non-interventionism of convenience, and how much are we talking about defining isolationism down? Because at this point, it's like if you don't want to have an undeclared, open-ended bombing campaign against a country that hasn't done anything to us at least since 1989. That makes you an isolationist.
Well, I think it's the latter. I think we've defined it a different way. We talk about, we always invoke Ronald Reagan and as a great man who understood that you need to be engaged internationally. He did, but he also pulled out of Lebanon when he realized that our presence there was simply putting ourselves at danger and that the benefits weren't great enough. So I think it's been defined differently now. I don't consider myself an isolationist at all, but I don't think it was right for us to engage in Libya. I don't think that the benefits outweighed the costs. I don't think that makes me an isolationist.
You're running for the Senate.
Yes.
What do you think of the two senators that Arizona has right now?
I'm a politician. I'm never going to say that. So let me just say, with regard to John Kyle, whom I hope to replace, to watch him stand up and retire with his wife standing by his side and without a scandal, without any, he's provided what I consider stellar service over a couple of decades. And he's at the top of his game as well in terms of power and influence. To see somebody like that just walk away, it doesn't happen often in Washington. It doesn't happen often that we walk away while people are still applauding. And that's certainly the case with John Kyle. And so I'm sorry to see him go, but Senate seats in Arizona come along with the frequency, open Senate seats, with the frequency of Halley's Comet, I think. Arizona has been a state for 100 years now, or just shy of 100, and we've only had 12 U.S. senators, and so the stars were aligned as well as they could be, and we announced just a few days after John Kyle announced that he would retire.
Immigration figures heavily in Arizona politics. It's the home of America's toughest sheriff. It's we've seen the laws and so forth. What's going on there? Why is Arizona different from New Mexico or Texas or Southern California even?
What you've seen over the past decade, I grew up in northern Arizona. I grew up on a ranch and a farm. We used labor from Mexico and south of the border. But at that time, typically, people would come work in Arizona, return home for the seasons, for birthdays, for anniversaries, whatever, because they could. And it was a circular pattern of migration. Over the past couple of decades, that circular pattern has become a settled pattern, where people cross once, bring their families, and stay, and then those costs are borne by Arizonans, and we feel it. We feel the brunt of it more than the federal government does, because we pay a big share of the costs, and also the nature of the border itself has changed as well. And this is more recent phenomenon. Just over the past few years, it used to be that it was the exception to the rule if somebody crossing the border was tied to drug smuggling or human smuggling. Virtually all of them were coming across to do work in the fields or in the hospitality industry or construction industry and to work. But now, because it's so expensive and dangerous to cross the border, virtually everyone that crosses hires a human smuggler. And because it's so expensive, an increasing number have to carry drugs to lessen the cost of their passage. And so the border itself has become much more dangerous. You've had a rancher killed there last year, and you have armed convoys coming across the border, often in the rural areas. And so the net effect down near the border for the landholders and others has just been a big change, and that's reflected in politics as well. Whereas you know, we've all wanted, and I believe still, ultimately you'll need a comprehensive solution to this problem that has a temporary worker plan and some mechanism to deal with those who are here illegally and interior enforcement. Until we get better security on the border, nobody's going to trust the federal government to move ahead on any of the other items.
Why does it never occur to anybody that the border becomes less secure the more it's policed? I mean, you know, as the border has become harder to get across, and as you mentioned, you have to hire coyotes or whatever,
right?
That has actually stopped the circular migration right. that you were just talking about.
I've always felt that the best way to secure the border is to have a legal framework for people to come and go, and then your resources can be deployed against those who are doing nefarious things on the border. And if we could return to a time like when I grew up, where there was that circular pattern, that would be one thing. But I think with the threats today, with terrorism and whatever else, I just don't think that we can return there. To have an open border like that just does not make sense for our security.
You grew up in northern Arizona in a place where the Mormon Church was very active, and you're one of the Mormons right. serving in office. We're in an interesting presidential field right now, right. where there we have a record number of Mormons and a record number of small government conservatives running. So how does that fit in? Has it ever affected you, do you think, in your own career?
No, I mean, from Arizona, there have been a number of Mormon legislators at the state level and the state legislature, well-respected individuals, and I've been fortunate to follow in their footsteps. And Arizona has a greater percentage of Mormons than a lot of states, perhaps. But nationwide, looking at the situation, it may not be a plus right now in some southern states to be a Mormon candidate, but I don't think it's a disqualifier anywhere. And so I think that the candidacy of Mitt Romney last time, and the fact that you have Harry Reid, a very prominent Democrat Mormon on one side, and Mitt Romney, John Huntsman, and others on the other side, it lets people know that there's little to fear there.
Sure. Is the issue overblown too? I remember there was a poll a few years ago claiming that it was being a Mormon was a bigger liability than I forget what the other liability, which were also not liabilities. It was right. like being a minority, being a woman, something like that.
Yeah.
Is that? I mean, do we make too much of that?
Yes, I think so. Somebody pointed out there was a recent poll that said there's still about 25% of the population that's uncomfortable voting for a Mormon, but it's also been pointed out that figure was higher for those who felt uncomfortable voting for a Catholic just prior to John F. Kennedy's election.
Right.
So I'm not sure that those polls capture the real feelings, and particularly in a year like this with the economy so poor. If you have somebody that is a great candidate in every other respect, I think a lot of people worry less about where they go to church.
Sure. Could you talk a little bit about the role of religion in public life, though? I mean, how it informs your own thinking. And certainly, it always seemed like Orrin Hatch was somebody who you could he was often off the reservation with the Republicans in terms of tolerance, on religious issues. And it seemed to me that was specifically because, you're coming from a place where everybody views you as something, as your own belief as something odd, and you kind of internalize that.
I don't know. I think everyone's religion informs their values, and it's difficult to decide where one ends and the other begins without getting into somebody's head or their heart. So I don't know how to answer that. My own religion, I assume like everyone else, does inform my values. but I don't think in a way that that makes anyone uncomfortable. That's not been my experience. I've not faced any incidents where people have been uncomfortable that way.
Well, you're going ahead with the Senate run. Your own seat is hotly contested. So, what happens next? I mean, where should what do you think we should be looking at in the complexion of the House and the Senate over the next couple of years?
Well, we have a good opportunity as Republicans now. The Democrats had a very good year in 2006, both in the House and the Senate. In the Senate, that means they have a lot of seats to defend in 2012. In fact, 23 of the 33 seats are Democrat seats. So I think we just need a net pickup of four as Republicans, and I think we can do it, and I think we're going to need to, regardless of who holds the White House. And I obviously, as a Republican, want a Republican in that seat. But when you look at the challenges this country is facing, so many of them won't be solved just by putting a Republican in the White House. We really need a Republican Senate as well. And I speak specifically about regulations, the federal agencies. I mean, these agencies are out of control. If we've seen anything over the past several months, it's these agencies, whether it's the EPA, whether it's financal regulations that have been imposed, these agencies just moving as if they need no congressional authority. And when you look at things that stifle the economy, it's not just tax rates, it's regulation, and we've got to get a handle on that. And so whether or not we have a Republican in the White House, if we can control the House and the Senate, we can have a huge impact on where these agencies go, what they regulate, what they don't. And that's what this economy really needs.
Yeah. What do you think of the argument that divided government is the friend of people who don't want the government to keep growing?
That's, if you look back in history, divided government has been good government if you want limited government. And I think you can find more instances of that than, you know, unified government, if you will, producing that outcome. So, yeah, I think that when you look at the 90s, for example, we've started to balance budgets. We had a good period of free trade and good economics without having a Republican in the White House. We can do that again. Like I said, I'm going to try to control every chamber and hope we behave differently next time. But yeah, divided government is often very good government.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.